future of the Commonwealth at all.
The new findings come on the heels of allegations earlier this year of racism within the ranks of the royal family from two of its members.
And also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born.
And of silence and denials from other members.
Very much not a racist man.
This week, the Queen will be marking a huge annual spectacle celebrating decades of her reign. Will the new revelations put a damper on the British monarch's so-called Platinum Jubilee? Saidpur is up, London.
The race for the top executive post in Iran rages on among the seven candidates who appear before reporters every day to outline their plans. Plans for a brighter future, stronger economy, and more opportunities for the youth. So journalists rarely ask contenders about what they have done in the past, but what they will do should they win the election.
The first move that my administration will focus on is to uproot poverty in the first year. If poverty is eliminated, our people will excel in culture and enlightenment.
I will pay special attention to the youth and their problems. Unemployment is now the first and foremost issue of our youth. As an economist, I believe that if we remove the uncertainty in our market, we can easily create jobs. Also, I will allow young experts to run at least 50% of my cabinet.
All of the candidates have so far spoken of problems that they blame on the incumbent government. Problems that range from inflation to unemployment. Some of the contenders find the root cause of these problems in the fact that outgoing President Rouhani has put all his eggs in the basket of the 2015 nuclear deal, which is now hanging by a thread.
Nobody can ignore the negative effects of the sanctions on our economy. But at the same time, we cannot reach out to our enemy and appeal to them to lift the sanctions. This method has not worked and will not work. We cannot pin hope on the lifting of sanctions to fix our economy. We should have relied on our own domestic capacities to have a resilient economy.
This year, the coronavirus pandemic has curtailed election rallies and electoral tours. Based on the guidelines set by the Coronavirus Combat Committee, campaigns are conducted through televised debates between candidates, feature documentaries, and speeches. Campaigning will continue until 24 hours before Election Day on June 18th. The Islamic Republic holds an average of one election each year since its establishment in 1979. Now candidates call on Iranians to turn up en masse for this year's election, as in the previous rounds, since high voter turnout is translated into a seal of approval for the legitimacy of the Islamic establishment. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Yair Lapid, the leader of Israeli opposition Yesh Atid party, informed the Israeli president that he can form a coalition cabinet. This brings to an end the era of long-time Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Under the coalition agreement, Lapid will share power with head of the right-wing Yamina, Naftali Bennett, who would be Netanyahu's immediate replacement. For the Palestinians, however, Netanyahu's removal would be no improvement, especially that the coming Prime Minister Bennett, who was a former settler leader, rejects Palestinian statehood. Palestinian officials say they expect Bennett's cabinet will even be more extreme than Netanyahu's.
For us, this coalition cabinet that was declared to replace Netanyahu's radical cabinet is even more radical when it comes to Israel's policies towards Palestinians. It will seek to expand settlements in the occupied lands. We trust none of Israeli parties. Their policy towards Palestinians won't be different.
Experts say that for the time being, Netanyahu's successors with their disparate agendas are expected to leave contentious issues unresolved. According to them, Bennett doesn't believe in a solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. His aim instead is to take full control of Palestinians. Moreover, they say, Bennett has some red lines he will never cross. He has long championed the right of settlement in the West Bank.
There is a consensus among all far-right parties when it comes to policies towards Palestinians. The two parties have already agreed to keep Area C of the West Bank under their control, which makes up almost 58% of the West Bank. The new cabinet will press ahead with the annexation plan, which is part of the so-called deal of the century.
Under the coalition agreement, Bennett and Lapid would rotate the role of prime minister, with Bennett taking up the post for the first 2 years and Lapid the final two.
Experts say Netanyahu will not let it go easily, as the parliament still has about 12 days to swear in the cabinet. During this period, Netanyahu will do his utmost to convince enough right-wing lawmakers to vote against the new cabinet. Mona Kandil, Occupy Ramallah.
To discuss the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, the Swedish Minister of Foreign Affairs, Ann Linde, met with the head of Yemen's negotiating delegation participating in peace talks in Oman's capital, Muscat. Mohammed Abdussalam said the blockade in Yemen goes against international law, and the Yemenis have the right to access food, medicine, and fuel, even under the ongoing war.
Sweden is one of the countries that support peace in Yemen and hosted talks between the warring sides in Stockholm back in 2018. This confirms Sweden's desire to find a permanent and comprehensive solution for Yemenis. Mohammed Abdussalam affirmed the same stance, which is the stance of all Yemenis who demand the lifting of the blockade and the entry of the oil ships. This will open a window to a fair political solution for both parties.
Abdussalam stated that Yemenis have welcomed any effort toward lifting the siege on their country and reaching a ceasefire. He added that no serious steps have been taken for ending the humanitarian crisis in his country, which means no serious steps have been taken in other areas.
The meeting that took place between Mohammed Abdussalam and the Swedish Foreign Affairs Minister confirms the right of the Yemeni people to obtain oil, food, and medicine and have the blockade lifted. These demands are in accordance with the character of the United Nations. The humanitarian crisis should not be linked to the military operations taking place on the ground. We are open to any negotiations, but with preserving the rights of the Yemeni people, the first of which is stopping the siege.
For weeks now, Oman's capital, Muscat, has been hosting fresh rounds of talks between the warring sides of Yemen. So far, the talks have failed in finding a peaceful solution to the years-long Saudi war on Yemen that has pushed the country to the brink of famine.
Lifting the siege has always been the main demand of all Yemenis who are looking forward to the end of their suffering. However, they say they are afraid that the war continues as the last round of negotiations has not yet yielded any results. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
The fifth round of talks between Iran and the remaining signatories of the nuclear deal known as the JCPOA concludes in Vienna. The objective, to bring the US back into the deal and to ensure the full implementation of Iran's nuclear commitments. EU coordinator Enrico Mora said the sticking points are fewer than they were a week ago.
It's a complex process with political decisions, with rather technical issues. They go in parallel. Now we are reaching a point in which we have to face the hard decisions. That's why it's only logical that head of delegations will go back to capitals. They will expose to their authorities the situation, and they will come back, I hope, with new, fresh ideas to finally close the negotiations.
Iranian lead delegate Deputy Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi said although the sides have made good progress, some key issues still need to be resolved. Iran has demanded the removal of all sanctions imposed, reimposed, or relabeled under the former U.S. administration, saying it will only return to full compliance after the verification of sanctions removal.
It is certainly the other side who has to make difficult decisions. What we need to do at the same time is on the implementation plans, decide on the methods and ways which meet our interest most. But for the US, for the other side, for Europeans, it is time to make difficult decisions. And I hope that they would be able to do that.
The Joint Commission will meet again in a week's time, and though the EU coordinator said he is absolutely sure the next round will be the last, Iran's lead delegate opted for a more cautious stance, saying that nothing can be predicted in such difficult negotiations. Homolesky, Vienna.
The European Commission reports that 45% of adults in the EU have now received their first dose of COVID-19 vaccine. In its latest budget policy recommendations under Economic Semester 2021, the Commission claims the vaccine rollout is providing hope.
Restrictions are being eased, and also more affected sectors are gradually again opening for business.
There is no official data available yet, but it is clear that right across the EU, businesses allowed to reopen in recent weeks simply have not. Government funding to support businesses while they were closed and financial support to keep jobs afloat is now being cut. This means the true scale of the economic crisis in the EU is very unclear at the moment. The bloc is on course, though, to vaccinate most adults before September the 1st. However, economists say that will not prove to be the proverbial silver bullet. Getting things back to how they were prior to COVID-19 will take years, they warn. Concern persists over the possibility that, as they emerge, new strains of COVID-19 might be resistant to existing vaccines.
Uncertainty is still high. We do not yet know what lasting effects crisis will leave, and also the exact impact of the recovery and resilience facility.
Even before we get to learn about the real data in the coming months, things are already bad.
The youth unemployment rate remains more than double the average unemployment rate.
Experts say the EU needs to focus much more on creating quality jobs for young people.
The European Union definitely needs to continue working and invest more money on young people. This is definitely a crucial point. As you also said, we are the future of the population in Europe.
There is massive government and personal debt in the EU. The European Commission has announced it will not enforce austerity on the 27 member states until 2023. The question is, how will citizens be impacted when that does start happening again? Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Hi, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Good morning.
Morning, sir.
Half a kilo of Halim, please.
Hi,
sir. Hi, kitty. Good morning.
Number one, hands up. Number two, hands on the waist.
Hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Get ready for jogging to warm up.
Hello, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
One loaf of well-baked bread, please.
Thank you.
the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who allowed none to witness when He created the heavens and the earth, and who took no helper when He authored the spirits. He has no associate in divinity and no support in unity. Tongues fall silent before the limits of describing Him. Intellects fail before the core of knowing Him. Terrents fall low in awe of Him. Faces are humbled in fear of Him. And everything mighty yields to His mightiness. So to Thee belongs praise again and again, well measured, continually, and methodically. And may His blessings be upon His messenger endlessly, and His salutation everlastingly, eternally. O Allah, make the beginning of this day of mine righteousness, its middle prosperity, and its end success. I seek refuge in Thee from a day whose beginning is fright, and whose middle is anxiety, and whose end is pain. O Allah, I pray forgiveness from Thee for every vow I have vowed, and every promise I have promised, and every pledge I have pledged, then failed to keep for Thee. I ask Thee concerning the complaints of Thy servants against me. If there is a servant from among Thy servants, of a handmaid from among Thy handmaids, who has against me a complaint, because I have wronged him in respect to himself, his reputation, his property, his wife or his child, or because evil words I have spoken about him in his absence, an imposition upon him through inclination, caprice, scorn, zeal, false show, bigotry, whether he be absent or present, alive or dead, such that my hand has fallen short and my capacity has been too narrow to make restitution to him or to annul my obligation to him, I ask Thee, O He who owns all objects of need which are granted by His will and hastened to His desire, that Thou blessest Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, peace be upon them, and makest the one I have wronged satisfied with me in the manner that Thou willst, and givest me mercy from Thee. Forgiveness decreases Thee not, and giving injuries Thee not. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, give me on every Monday two favors from Thee: the facility to obey Thee at its beginning, and the favor of Thy forgiveness at its end. O He who is Allah, and none other than whom grants forgiveness for sin.
The debate.
Hello and welcome to Debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, it is not likely that any of the top brass of the Saudi Arabia at the start of their onslaught on Yemen thought that 6.5 years later, they would still be fighting. And now it is the Yemeni military, along with Ansarullah fighters, who are now attacking Saudi Arabia. Yemeni army spokesman announced that Yemen had initiated retaliatory attacks inside of Saudi Arabia on the King Khalid military base in Aser. Stay with us as we take a look at how the tables have turned on the Saudi regime.
The Yemeni army has carried out another successful massive operation that was announced by the spokesman for the Yemeni army, Yahya Saria, who described the offensive as a major victory in the southern Saudi Jazan region.
There is no doubt that this operation will affect the Saudi enemy severely, especially as it comes at a time when the Marib fronts and other fronts are under much pressure. Thus, these back-to-back victories confirm Saudi Arabia's inability to achieve any of the goals declared at the beginning of the war. The Saudi-led coalition failed in the military confrontation, while the Yemeni army continued to significantly improve its capabilities.
The spokesman stated that this operation comes in response to the escalation of Saudi Arabia's war and its ongoing siege on Yemen. Military experts said this victory could be part of the ongoing talks, as it will push Riyadh further to accept a fair political solution.
Every military operation, including the Jizan operation, has political dimensions. Saudi Arabia is an arrogant country that believes its capabilities and the support it receives by Britain and America will help it achieve something in the field. Today, the Yemeni army proved that it is capable of gaining military control and that the battle has moved deep inside Saudi soil. Saudi Arabia is forced to move forward a political solution, but militarily it has completely failed.
Earlier, Yemen's armed forces carried out a retaliatory attack against the King Khalid Air Base in Azir using Qassam K2 drones. The Saudi war has brought about the world's worst humanitarian crisis in Yemen, according to the United Nations.
Observers say the ongoing operation by the Yemeni army has sent a clear message to Saudi Arabia, and that is, as long as the Saudi war and siege against Yemen is persist, Yemen's army will carry out more massive retaliation military attacks deep inside the kingdom. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana.
I'd like to welcome my guest to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and Elijah Makian, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start it off in Toronto. And Zafar, how could the Saudis have miscalculated Yemen this much? I mean, they thought the war would not take more than a month or two. Your assessment?
Well, basically, the Saudi defense minister, who is now also the crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, when he was first appointed, he was full of arrogance. He thought that the Saudi army, because it is equipped with a lot of weapons, would be able to wipe out any Yemeni resistance. But what he did not realize was, number one, that the Saudi army is not motivated. In fact, they are not really capable of fighting. Number two, they underestimated the Yemenis' resistance. The point is that the Yemenis are fighting for their land, for their honor, for their principle. What the Saudis are doing is they are the aggressors. They want to occupy somebody else's land, and they want to install a puppet regime in Yemen. Obviously, that is not acceptable to the Yemeni people. Secondly, the Saudis counted on a number of mercenaries. In fact, they approached a number of countries, including countries like Pakistan and Egypt and so on, hoping that they would send their armed forces to support the Saudis, and these countries refused. So the Saudis had to resort to mercenaries from South America, from Africa, from Sudan, etc. But naturally, even these mercenaries cannot continue to wage a war on behalf of the Saudis. So as you mentioned, it's been more than 6 years, and I think the Saudi army and their soldiers, etc., have realized that this is a lost cause, and the best thing is not to put up a fight, and in fact, many of them are surrendering.
Well, Elijah, the Saudis initiated a ruthless onslaught on Yemen back in 2015, bombing civilian areas and infrastructure, and also implementing a land, air, and sea siege of the area. I mean, what was Riyadh really trying to accomplish with this type of violence against the civilian population in Yemen?
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming.
There are 2 points. First of all, Saudis are trying to submit Yemen
to its control, because Yemen is considered its backyard. And secondly, they are afraid of the influence of Iran in Yemen. This is what the Saudis started the war, thinking that it is a promenade, and thinking that in a matter of weeks this will end. It has been 6 years, and during these 6 years, the Yemeni learned how to make their own bombs, have learned the art of war, and they have also learned how to retaliate. And what we have seen very recently in the last 24 hours, how the Yemeni are taking the initiative and attacking Jazan and making really strong progress. Now, what Saudi Arabia is doing is really destroying Yemen. The cost of war so far is estimated around $100 billion. And the only thing that Saudis have achieved so far is the destruction of the country, where there is the largest humanitarian crisis ever against the poorest country in the Middle East. We saw the Yemenis are learning how to fight back, how to make missiles, and how to do their own drones and armed drones, and how to retaliate and hurt Saudi Arabia. And I think now the Saudis are trying to find a way out, but they want to gain in negotiation what they failed to gain in the war.
Okay.
Therefore, the Houthis... Yes, sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, let me just get Zafar back in on this discussion. Well, although the Yemenis have been under a Saudi siege, Yemeni fighters and Houthis have continually improved, so much so that they are now attacking Saudi Arabia. What do you attribute this to? I mean, how are they able to do this despite the siege?
Well, I think we need to keep in mind that the Yemenis are one people that has never, ever surrendered to foreign forces. That goes to their credit. Secondly, as your guest pointed out, the Yemenis have been able to make immense progress in terms of developing their military capabilities. Yemen already had actually a missile industry before the Saudis launched a war against them, but it was not as advanced as it has become now. And thirdly, the Saudi army, that is, they're not only totally incompetent, they're also demoralized. So what the Yemenis have been able to do is, because of their determination, because of the fact that their cause is just, they are fighting to defend their own land. They're not committing aggression. In fact, even the operations that they are carrying out inside Saudi Arabia in provinces like Jizan and Asir, these actually belong to the Yemeni people. These were illegally occupied by the Saudis in 1934. So perhaps this Saudi aggression against Yemen that was launched in March of 2015 may turn out to be a blessing in disguise for the Yemenis, despite the enormous sacrifices that they have had to make, but that they perhaps might be able to reclaim the land that the Saudis had illegally occupied back in 1934. So their cause is just, they are highly motivated, they are excellent fighters, they have never surrendered to any foreign forces. All of these factors actually go in favor of the Yemeni people. Mm.
Okay. Well, Elijah, I mean, how significant in your perspective that we've seen the Yemeni forces just attacking a military base by drone inside of Saudi Arabia, and we've seen other retaliatory attacks and dealing with oil tankers. How disruptive has this been?
I think that had significant effect on Saudi Arabia economy, reputation, and finance. We saw how the Yemeni were able to disrupt the oil flow from Saudi Arabia to the rest of the world for several days, and even for a couple of weeks. And we saw how the Yemeni were able to hit inland in Saudi Arabia and to give back the same amount of, not the same amount, but to retaliate in Saudi Arabia in different area, even going toward far in Saudi Arabia, so 1,200 kilometers. We saw how the Yemeni were capable to force the Saudis to the negotiation table. Unfortunately, the Americans are negotiating on behalf of the Saudis now in Sana'a, and not the Saudis, because they don't have the skills or the courage to negotiate.
Well, what about that, Zafar? Elia talked about the Americans negotiating on behalf of the Saudis. Your perspective on the United States, do you think that at this point in time that they want this war to end? Are you detecting some type of changing perspective coming out of Washington? Are your assessment overall?
Well, the Americans are actually trying to change the perception, but not their policy. So while Biden and his regime continues to talk about not providing offensive weapons to the Saudis, but we have seen no evidence that they have stopped supplying weapons to the Saudis, or that they are still providing logistical and intelligence support to the Saudis. So these negotiations that are taking place under the UN auspices regarding Yemen, obviously, as Elijah pointed out, these are basically guided by the Americans, because America virtually controls the United Nations, and so it is actually dictating the agenda. But what is important and crucial for your viewers to understand is that the Yemenis, throughout this war on them, have maintained the high moral ground. The Saudis have been attacking civilian infrastructure. The Yemeni Ansarullah fighters have not attacked any civilian infrastructures. They have targeted military installations. They have targeted economic installations. There was only one instance, in fact, when the Yemenis fired a missile at a palace in which they thought the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman was staying. So throughout these 6+ years, the Yemenis have only targeted military installations because they do not believe in inflicting civilian casualties, although they can. So on these counts, I think the Yemenis really maintain the high moral ground, and they are fully justified in not accepting any demands that the Americans make of them.
Well, Elijah, what about Riyadh itself? Do you think it is looking for a way to end this war now?
Riyadh is really willing to come out of this problem that Saudi Arabia put itself in, and we cannot exclude the couple of meetings that happened between Saudi Arabia and Iran in Baghdad, where the Saudis on the top of their agenda was the situation in Yemen. And we saw how Minister Zarif went to Muscat, Salam, to slow down on the base that the Saudis will lift the siege. And the Yemeni made it very clear, we cannot stop the war on our side because the Houthis are now dictating the battle. They said, we cannot stop the war on our side unless you lift the siege, and we will not accept an exchange of ceasefire in exchange of humanitarian aid. You allow us to survive, you allow us to live. We want the 16 ships that are full of oil. There is no oil in Yemen today, and we want all the aids before we start talking about a ceasefire. Today, Saudi Arabia is trembling of the idea that the Houthis are going to liberate Marib, and this is going to happen very soon. And I think they will liberate Marib and get their oil rich before accepting a ceasefire.
Okay. Well, Zafar, there seems to be a unique strength and determination in the Yemeni people. I mean, what is it that makes them so determined, although the Saudi regime is killing civilians on a regular basis, as well as destroying the infrastructure, restricting basic necessities, and at least 16 million Yemenis are estimated to be food insecure out of a population of 29 million, and they have refused to surrender to the Saudi regime. And you touched on this a bit, but I'd like for you to expand on it.
Sure. Basically, as I mentioned, the Yemeni people are absolutely brilliant fighters. There are very few other people in the world, perhaps I might even mention the Afghans, who have defeated now the third superpower of their time. But the Yemenis are absolutely determined fighters. But what is also very crucial to keep in mind is that the Yemenis don't rely only on weapons, they rely on their faith. They have a firm conviction in God's help, They are very, very determined people. They are very pious people. As I mentioned, they have not targeted civilians in Saudi Arabia, although they are quite capable of doing it, which shows that they have maintained the high moral ground. They have maintained their dignity and their honor in the face of all of these extremely difficult conditions that have been imposed upon them. I mean, you know, a country that is under total siege, they cannot get food in, they cannot get oil in, and you know, millions of people are starving. More than a million children are afflicted by cholera epidemic. I mean, this is absolutely unheard of in recent history. And yet, the Yemenis have maintained their dignity and honor because they have such strong commitment to Allah and to Islam, mm-hmm. and they want to maintain that, and that is the reason why they have been successful. And I think we should take heart from this fact that whenever Muslims, regardless of where they are, for instance, you can look at the situation in Palestine, in Gaza, again, the commitment of the people of Palestine and their firm commitment to Allah has provided them these opportunities. So I think this is a very important lesson for Muslims worldwide, okay. that instead of relying on weapons, they can rely on the help of Allah and remain steadfast.
Well, what about that, Elijah? You heard Zafar, he talked about Palestine. I want to look at this because something else unique about the Yemenis, at the despite all of the hardships that we've just mentioned, some of them, they've recently been raising money for the Palestinians after the situation that took place 11 days onslaught, Israeli onslaught on Gaza. They have been busy raising money and giving support to the Palestinian cause despite them being under such pressure. Now, both of these groups, it's interesting, if we look at the similarities of what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Yemen, both under siege, and the resistance despite this pressure both being effective. Your take on this?
This is a very important question. Apart from the touching move of the Yemeni, who are really starving and have very little asset, they managed to put together over $200,000. I mean, look at the amount they managed to put together to send it to Gaza and to support the Palestinian population. This gesture is very significant. But the most significant, we see how the axis of the resistance that goes from Yemen to Tehran, to Baghdad, to Syria, Damascus, and to Lebanon, and to end in Gaza, how it is all compact and it's holding together. When Yemen came out and said, we are waiting for Gaza to tell us if they need us to fight and to support them, this is extremely significant because that is the work of all these years to bring out a line of population ready to fight against the aggressor, whoever they are, wherever they are, whoever they are, because even if they are very strong, the people of Yemen express their solidarity with Gaza to tell them that you are not alone and this whole front is here to support you. The creation of this front is the most significant issue in all of this.
Zafar, your take on this resistance front and being in solidarity now, of course, had been before, but definitely seeming to be even more effective than it has been. Your assessment?
Absolutely. In fact, as we see these developments unfold, the resistance front is gaining more and more strength. And this clearly indicates that the resistance front, which obviously the Islamic Republic of Iran is a major component of, has been motivated to a level whereby these resistance fighters are not guided by any worldly considerations, but in fact, they are determined to uphold truth and justice, whether it is in Yemen, in Gaza, in Lebanon, in the rest of Palestine, in Iraq, where they are facing this American occupation, or in Syria, which again is has been subjected to this horrendous mercenary onslaught from all over the world, and of course with the American forces over there, But the fact that the Islamic Republic was upfront in supporting Syria, because Syria is a very, very important component for the resistance front in order to be able to provide material support to Hezbollah in Lebanon, as well as material support to the people of Gaza. So we see that the resistance front is actually operating on very high moral principles and upholding justice and fairness. And I think any people that stand up for truth and justice and show solidarity, I think ultimately they will triumph.
And Elijah, your take now that not only the resistance front, but we look at Yemen itself, the military and Ansarullah, the Houthis are getting stronger by the day. Do you see a light at the end of the tunnel as far as this war? Do you think that we're heading towards the end of the Saudi onslaught on Yemen?
Actually, I do, because today we see the axis of the resistance coming together, but we also see another element wherever there is an attack against one member of the axis of the resistance. The operational theater can be anywhere in these countries, and we're talking about Yemen, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and Gaza. And this solidarity is forcing the other side, who is fighting in these countries, particularly the United States, to stop this war, to try to do something to stop this solidarity that is already made, and nothing can stop it. Therefore, I think the Saudis are really seriously going toward a ceasefire, because they have lost the battle and they want to end it, come out with the less damage possible. Therefore, the negotiation that is happening in Muscat today, the Americans are trying to gain some ground, and the Houthis are very firm, and they will continue to do so. And I think it is an advantage of the Saudis and the American to end this war, and I think this is going to happen most probably this year.
All right, and on that note, appreciate both of you being with us for this debate. Zafar Bankash, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought out of Toronto, and Elijah McNear, journalist and political analyst out of Brussels. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another debate. I'm Marzia Hashimi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The American gun industry is consistently ramping up production. There are currently about 400 million guns in circulation in the United States, a country of 330 million, says Ramsin Cannon writer in an article titled "American Gun Manufacturers Are Endangering Public Health." They should be held liable. Stay tuned for more. The last 2 weeks, coincident with warming weather and incrementally looser quarantine restrictions, saw two more mass shootings in Atlanta, Georgia area in Boulder, Colorado. Is it true that only a global pandemic forcing people indoors was enough to significantly slow the pace of that American phenomena, mass shootings? As communities, families, governments, and the media react to these shootings, forensically analyzing the conditions that led to them, there are numerous variables. While the perpetrators are overwhelmingly men, often young men and usually white, their motives, background, social and economic class tend to be variable. white supremacy and misogyny, or both, as was the case in Georgia massacre, are often at the root of the shootings. Others' roots have remained mysterious. The instrument of death, however, is constant. Firearms. There is another constant, too. The manufacturers of these tools for committing massacres are legally shielded from liability for their overproduction and dangerous marketing strategies. Until that changes, massacres of these types will likely continue. After the Atlanta area killings, it was widely reported that the shooter was able to buy a gun and begin his attacks on the same day. Without a strategy that attacks the forces of capital benefiting from the flood of guns, ever-increased policing will just drag more and more people into the carceral U.S. system. As it stands, the pain of mass shootings is borne by victims, their families and communities, and the public. Meanwhile, the gun industry is consistently ramping up production. There are currently about 400 million guns in circulation in the United States of America, a country of 330 million. Getting guns into circulation quickly is an acknowledged part of the strategy of undercutting regulatory efforts. There needs to be a direct connection between the social and public health impact of gun proliferation and the cost imposed on the industry. Put another way, regulations like stricter design standards and safety features are sensible and could be effective, but they will ultimately become an error line in the cost of production calculation of manufacturers. Meanwhile, the public absorbs billions in public health and social decay impacts that the manufacturers are never called to account for. Regulations disconnected from the actual cost on the public will end up as legislative tug of war so long as there is an immensely profitable industry untouched by the cost of their conduct. The main plain way to impose a cost on the gun manufacturing industry is repealing the Protection of Lawful Commerce in Arms Act, that is PLCAA, and subjecting the industry to public nuisance and public health theories of liability. These strategies would begin to compel the industry to bear actual constant and proportional costs of its reckless overproduction and marketing of arms. To better understand what this means in practice, it's important to understand the unique challenge the firearms industry poses. Unlike most products, guns are intended to maim and kill. So, there is little room for the product liability theory, under which a consumer sues the manufacturer of a product for a defect in a product. A gun that maims or kills has most likely operated perfectly well, not defectively. So the public is left with two primary paths: claims of negligence in the form of negligent marketing, and public nuisance claims. In negligent marketing claims, plaintiffs could allege that manufacturers knowingly oversell handguns, particularly into markets with more lax gun regulations, knowing that the initial and wholesale purchasers are essentially buying for sale into second-hand markets, including gun shows and private sales. The proliferation of guns drives the prices down and increases the ease with which any given person can secure a firearm fairly easily. The public nuisance theory has even greater potential. Rooted in the common law, the concept of public nuisance is that the public has certain general rights that should not be violated by private actors. The most obvious examples being factories that create a noise nuisance or polluters that contaminate drinking water. In the context of gun crime, the theory would be that the public safety, the right to be free from actual occurrence or constant risk of bodily harm from guns, has been recklessly or intentionally harmed by gun manufacturers. In the last handful of years, suits brought against pharmaceutical companies involved in the production of opioids have rested on a public nuisance and seen access in the form of large settlements as companies scramble to avoid bellwether verdicts that create templates for more lawsuits. The opioid industry has been one of the parties complicit in hundreds of thousands of overdose deaths in the last 20 years in the U.S., as well as untold millions of destroyed lives and dilapidation of families and communities. But there is a critical difference. Opioids, at least, do have an important functional use, easing serious pain, and their manufacturers produce myriad other products that are critical to public health. The firearms industry has no comparable social value, and therefore, legislators should feel freer to legislate for broader grounds and steeper penalties for liability. The proliferation of guns has imposed immense financial costs even beyond the generally circulated figure of $170 billion annually. Consider, for example, the cost of the purchase, maintenance, and replacement of tens of thousands of metal detectors in public schools and other public buildings, added security for those same facilities, the knock-on cost of overburdened trauma centers in major urban centers, etc. When you consider that the only arguable public utility of gun ownership is to protect against other people with guns, the industry can and should be wholly liable for these costs borne by the public. Yet currently, the industry has no material negative feedback from mass shootings. The increase in gun production over a period of increased mass shootings demonstrates this fairly unequivocally. The industry needs to feel the same panic and dread the public does after a massacre. And that is only likely to happen when it can expect to be compelled into the courthouse and made to pay for its reckless conduct. Under the current Second Amendment regime, imposing steep costs for the proliferation of guns is the only apparently evident means of standing their flow. Stopping the overproduction of guns serves multiple purposes. By starting to dry up the supply, it reduces the prevalence of gun crimes, which in turn could help stem the demand for more guns, since guns are generally purchased for self-defense. In turn, that begins the process of drying up the immense profits of the industry. Imposing liability on the gun industry through state and private litigation commencing in myriad jurisdictions all at once can quickly sap the industry's war chest, tie up its resources, and send insurers fleeing. All of these steps could in turn give policymakers and communities breathing space to experiment with deeply needed public health approaches to addressing gun violence, rather than merely creating more and more intrusive policing strategies that will inevitably fall hardest on the working class communities of color.
Good morning.
from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.